offering by Sarah Sindert on botanical drawing is part of the 100 year celebration. So we're very fortunate to have had Mrs. Brian Huntley offer at the very, very beginning of last year already this course. He is coordinating the course. You'll see there are very many different speakers and is speaking on a wide range of topics. The very important and interesting work that is done by what is South African National Botanical Institution. Professor Huntley is a conservation scientist with over 45 years of field research and management experience in many African countries. Has initiated and led to conclusions several major interdisciplinary cooperative research and institutional development projects, and has been invited to over 50 countries as an invited speaker and reviewer of conservation activities. Following Professor Huntley's retirement as CEO of the South African National Botanical Institute, he is currently engaged as an independent consultant on conservation projects in several African countries, and he reviews the conservation projects around the world. Please warm welcome Professor Brian Huntley.
Thank you, Betty. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's wonderful to be here on this beautiful Cape morning, and thank you for coming to join me to listen to some stories about Kirstenbosch. As we've just heard, this is the centennial year of Kirstenbosch, and it seemed fitting, given our very close association with University of Cape Town over many years, that we should participate in the summer school this year to celebrate with you various aspects of the Kirstenbosch garden, its establishment, its history, and some of the activities that are taking place there. We have five talks today on the Kirstenbosch story. Tomorrow, the flora of South Africa, Dr. John Manning, who has written very widely on this topic. On Wednesday, we have cycads, those incredible plants that lived in the time of the dinosaurs, by Professor John Donaldson. And then Thursday, traditional plant use, Pakamani Khaba will be talking about the use of South Africa's indigenous plants, both in medicine and in other traditional uses. And then on Friday, we close with a presentation on climate change and the Fynbos biome by Guy Midgley. So that's the program for the week. Having recently published a book on Kirstenbosch, which I'm pleased to see is on sale up in the bookshop here, you're welcome to get yourself a copy. Having recently done this fairly comprehensive review of the life and times of Kirstenbosch, I decided that the story was far too broad to cover in a 40-minute presentation, and so I've chosen to focus on just one aspect which I think is relevant to where we are today, and that is the relationship that we have enjoyed with the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, over the years since shortly after Kew was established. Kew was established 250 years ago, and very soon after that, the relationship with South Africa commenced. I take the title of this presentation from a comment made by Jan Smuts in July 1923 at the opening of the Pretoria National Herbarium, when he asked the public whether they wanted a queue for South Africa. Now, that provoked some rather irritated responses, and I'm going to come back to that. But the thrust of this presentation is the relationship, as I say, between Kew and Kirstenbosch. And if one looks across the 240 years where we've had this active relationship, There are three main episodes or pulses of activity. Each of these around the turn of the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. Episodes of about 30 to 40 years where there was high levels of activity. So we see episode one, the late 18th century, with personalities such as Banks, Masson, and Burchell, discovery, inventory, development of horticulture. The next pulse was at the end of the 19th century, with Thiselton Dyer, Paul Evans, Pearson. And that was where the institution developed and where the links between Kew and South Africa and Kirstenbosch were formalized and founded. The last episode is the last 20 years and perhaps the next. And that was with a series of directors at Kew, players at Kew such as Gren Lucas, Ian Prance, Peter Crane, Steve Hopper, and myself, my own involvement from this end. And that was where we focused more on conservation science and on African connections. Now, before we leap into the last 250 years, I just want to step back a little to the birth of South African botany, because the recorded history, the published history of South African botany goes back to this picture on the left of Proteinaria folia by Clusius in 1605, the first South African plant to be illustrated in a scientific journal way back 400 plus years ago. On the right you see the same plant, Proteinaria folia, collected there in Kuchelbaai, as you know it, on this beautiful coastline of ours, painted by my botanical artist daughter. So over a period of 400 years, you have two images of this very important plant, the first to be illustrated from the flora of Africa south of the equator. A second note from that time was that made by Linnaeus when he had gone through the collections made by Herman, the first professional botanist to visit the Cape. Linnaeus only studied this work much later, these collections much later, but his comment that this land of the Cape of Good Hope in farthest Africa, no botanist ever before had trod. O Lord, how many, how rare, and how wonderful were the plants that presented themselves to Herman's eyes. In a few days, Herman simply and solely discovered more new African plants than all the botanists who have ever before him made their appearance in the world. Isn't that wonderful that just in that time, in this visit of 1672, Herman was on his way to Ceylon. He stopped over for a few days and he made this marvelous collection of plants. So this immediately told the world that the Cape had something very exciting. Well, let's leap forward then 100 years to 1771. This first major episode of activity. And the key play here was Sir Joseph Banks. He was the great patron of science in Georgian England. He was a great sponsor of expeditions science, the founding and the development of the Royal Society. A key player in the history of science, both in the UK and throughout the world. He had visited Cape Town in 1771. He had been so impressed by what he saw that when he got back to the UK, to England, rather, he immediately spoke with George III and suggested they send a botanist. Now, this took us into 1772, which can be seen as the founding era, the founding moment of South African botany. It was in that year, 1772, that three great botanists, horticulturists, scientists arrived in Cape Town in quick succession. First to arrive was Anders Sparman, the Swede, student of the great Linnaeus, on the 13th April, and then just 3 days later, Thunberg arrived, also a Swede, and also a student of Thunberg, of Linnaeus. And then a few months later, Francis Masson. These were products of the Age of Enlightenment, imbued with a reckless search for the truth. And here they were in the Cape, looking through the flora of this remarkable area. One could spend a series of lectures just devoted to Sparman, Thunberg, and to Masson. We can't do that. All I can do is highlight a few of their contributions. We know that Thunberg was the father of South African botany. He published the first Flora Capensis. Sparman, of course, left soon after the arrival of the Endeavour in the Cape in October. He left, Masson got off the ship, Sparman went around the Southern Ocean with Cook and came back, and then spent several years more in the Cape collecting and writing, and his writings are fascinating reading, as we all know. But Masson had come to the Cape because he was a gardener. And at that time, in the late 18th century, the thinking at Kew was that one should employ Scots gardeners. They were much more thrifty and reliable than the English. So Masson was sent off to the Cape, not a scientist, but a gardener, a plantsman. And that was where his importance lay. He collected this grand trio of 1772, collected no fewer than 1,500 new species, new to science. But more importantly for the gardening community of the world was Masson's collections, because he had an eye for horticultural importance. He collected 400 new introductions into horticulture. They swept off to England, and of course his patron, George III, was delighted with the arrival in England of the Strelitzia, which was of course named after his queen. Now, the gems of the Cape included so many different genera, so many different families, so many different species. One of the really sparkling plants was this Erica Massoni, named after Masson, of course. And at that time, the king's botanical artist, Francis Bauer, was illustrating these gems from the Cape in exquisite technical and aesthetic detail and beauty. And it was his work which the great art historian William Stern described as nearer to perfection in this field of art and scholarship than anyone before and since. And if you have a chance to look at some of the folios that are, in the National Herbarium Library in Pretoria, and there are some in the Compton Herbarium at Kirstenbosch, you'll see the exquisite beauty of his work. Now, that big pulse from 1772 continued into the early 1800s, and during that period, a whole sweep of botanists came through. There was, of course, the first of the trio that I've described. Then another Scotsman, William Paterson, came, collector for the Countess of Strathmore. The Germans, Franz Boos and George Schull, collectors for Emperor Joseph III. Another Scots, James Niven, who was here collecting for Empress Josephine. The Austrian, Ferdinand Bauer, that's the brother of Francis Bauer, he came through, also a brilliant artist. The German, Martin Lichtenstein, who was family doctor to the governor at the Cape. The English explorer and scientist, William Burchell, and we'll return to him. Botanical artist, we've mentioned. Another Scot, James Bowie, we will return to him. And then a trio of German collectors, who collected 200,000 specimens of the Cape flora of 8,000 species, which they dispatched to the herbaria of Europe, and which are the sort of foundations of many of the herbaria in Europe. That was Zaya, Eklon, and Dresch. So there was this massive activity at the turn of the 18th into the early 19th century here. These are some of the treasures that went across as bulbs to Europe and started populating the gardens and the conservatories of Europe from that period. Many of them were established, many of the proteas were established, the ericas were established in Europe by the turn of the 18th century. The great hero of this era, however, was not from Kew, but from England, William Burchell, who came to the Cape via St. Helena, and his contribution in his two volumes of his travels are, in my perspective, my view, the most beautifully written of all of the travel tales of Africa. He was not only a very perceptive, active, and productive collector. He collected more plants and scientific specimens in Africa than any other single collector, any other visitor. In his 4 years of travels over 7,000 kilometers, he accumulated something like 65,000 specimens of plants, animals, geological specimens. And also, of course, a huge amount of information, local information, the names and of places and plants of the Khoi Khoi people and the San people that he recorded. But perhaps his most important contribution for us was his visit just up the ridge behind us, Weinberg Hill, just across that way, where he walked up to a point above Kirstenbosch on the 14th of March, 1811, and he wrote on that day, "And if in the vicinity of Cape Town a well-organized botanic garden of sufficient extent were established for the purpose of receiving plants which could be collected in the more distant parts of the colony, the sum of money required for maintaining it would be trifling." Now, that's what he stated in 1811. Sadly, it would be a century before that dream of a garden at Kirstenbosch was established, but nevertheless, this is where he looked. If you walk up from the top gate, you walk up towards Skeleton Gorge, Nursery Gorge, you'll see this view across the garden. And his description of his view is, again, one of the sort of poetic lines in his book. "Our walk conducted us to a high point of the hill that overlooks Kirstenbosch," using an old spelling, "a beautiful estate belonging to the government. The view from this spot, and indeed all the scenery around, is the most picturesque of any I have seen in the vicinity of Cape Town. The beauty here displayed to the eye could scarcely be represented by the most skillful pencil." Now, those of you who know Kirstenbosch, you'll agree, his view of Kirstenbosch was as good then as it is today, 200 years later. The first collector, botanical collector, sent by Kew to South Africa was Masson. Time went by, and a little later, James Bowie, an old Scot, Scot was sent out to collect. He was not a success. Peter McCown, a very acerbic writer of the history of botany in South Africa in the 1880s, said of Bowie, "Having a want of application and business aptitude, his great pleasure was to spend his time among the free and easy company of bar parlors, recounting apocryphal stories of his Brazilian and Cape travels, largely illustrated with his big snake and wildebeest adventures." You can imagine him in the bars, the taverns of London, regaling the audience about his wildebeest and big snake adventures. He, of course, wasn't maintained on the Kew payroll. He returned to the Cape hoping to be able to make some money out of collecting and selling plants. He had a bit of a sad and dissolute end to his stay here, but that was the last of the Kew collectors to come to the Cape. So, the accumulated information from all these botanists and travellers in the Cape was disorganised. It was all over the place. It was in herbaria around the world, and it took a self-taught Irishman, self-taught botanist, William Henry Harvey, who came to the Cape not as a botanist, but as colonial treasurer in 1835. He spent 4 years here between 35 and 42 as colonial treasurer. And in fact, there's a story about that which time won't allow. However, he used his spare time to write up the genera of South African plants. The first book on botany to be published in Cape Town. When he assembled this information, he was able to document 7,620, I think it was, species, the first comprehensive listing for the Cape flora, South African flora. That book, his personal copy of that book, with all his hand annotations, page by page, it's almost an encyclopedia of his updating of information around the flora of South Africa, is in the possession of the Mary Gunn Library at Pretoria, at the National Herbarium. So it's wonderful to be actually to see this first volume on botany of South Africa with the author's notes. He, in one of his writings, he suggested that this book that he had published could be, copies can be sent to resident doctors, clergymen, etc., scattered about the country to excite their idle minds to send specimens to the Cape. I thought that was brilliant. There in that day, you had colonial officials, teachers, clergymen all over the country, and their wives, collecting plants, and he wished to inspire these idle minds to contribute to the flora, the botany of South Africa. Well, that sort of ended that episode. We go to the second episode from about 1895 to 1935. I failed to mention that Harvey, the Irishman, had started in the 1850s and into the 60s, before he died, the Flora Capensis, this great work. He died in 65, and the work lay dormant until William Turner Thistleton Dyer, who became director of Kew, picked it up and started continuing the huge succession of volumes that came out, completed in 1935. So this was a project that had gone over 75 years before conclusion, and Thistleton Dyer was the main person that drove it in that second phase. He didn't come to the Cape, but he could see the importance of the Cape. He said, "At present, the Cape Colony is the only important British possession which does not possess a fully equipped botanical institution. A central establishment in the neighbourhood of Cape Town, devoted to the scientific study and experimental cultivation of plants, fully equipped to discharge its duties as a national institution on the lines of Kew, would alone be worthy of the future of South Africa." So that was in 1895. Thistleton Dyer was the first to plant the seed of an idea of a Kew of South Africa. He also drew attention to a very important aspect of the flora. "The flora of this part of the world is of extreme interest. It deserves to be carefully and exhaustively studied, and numerous plants, now in danger of becoming extinct, should be preserved in some central spot for the observation of students. So there he was indicating the importance of the flora and the danger of the threats to it that it might become extinct. In the same year, the great Baron Ferdinand Müller in Australia, who was the father of Australian botany, in correspondence with Sir Hercules Robinson, who was at that time the High Commissioner, the British High Commissioner in the Cape, wrote the following. This is his view from Australia. He's received many herbarium specimens from his colleagues in the Cape. He says, the vegetation of South Africa is the richest in the world. Special and peculiar plants, sure to be swept out of existence altogether unless special provision is made for their preservation. In future centuries, hundreds of these beautiful and remarkable plants will be unknown save by dried specimens preserved in state herbaria. So, incredibly forward-thinking, and indeed many of the plants that we know today to be extinct or on the verge of extinction are known only from those state herbaria that he was referring to over 100 years ago. Now, Thistleton Dyer had a very bright young man working for him in 1899, Henry Harold Welch Pearson, who, born in Lincolnshire in 1870, a brilliant scholar at Cambridge, went to Sri Lanka to work in the great botanical garden at Peradeniya. Returns to Cambridge, and then became Thistleton Dyer's assistant. Thistleton Dyer was apparently a dictatorial misogynist. He didn't want any women in Kew. He ran the place like a military encampment. And Pearson, the young Pearson, learnt a lot from this difficult director of Kew. But Thistleton Dyer was ahead of his time in many things, and I think Pearson benefited from this. Pearson, of course, had a passion for gymnosperms, for cycads particularly, and it is said that he came to South Africa. He was appointed the first Harry Bowles Professor of Botany at University of Cape Town in 1903. He came to the Cape, they say, because he wanted to study Welwitschia. He wanted to get closer to Welwitschia, which indeed he did. He made several expeditions across Southwest Africa, or Namibia today, into southern Angola. And this is what he would have found and described in exquisite detail in his publications on Welwitschia and on other gymnosperms. This is what I found a century after he had been by. It hadn't grown that fast. This plant is reputedly 2,000 years old. But it's in the same area of a remote, inhospitable, difficult part of southwest Angola that Pearson, I think, was so excited by his exploration of Welwitschia's biology and morphology, for which he received the fellowship of the Royal Society in 1916. This was what he was after. This was before he made his visits in 1911 with Pilans and with Ridley to the gate, the re-established old gate of Kirstenbosch. But I will not go into the history of his fight for the establishment of Kirstenbosch. That's a whole story in itself. Let's just remember that on the 1st of July 1913, Kirstenbosch became the property of the Board of Trustees of the National Botanic Gardens of South Africa. This was 50 years later, this scene here of a spring scene, and here we've got it a century after establishment. So Kirstenbosch has been favoured with firstly having a forward-thinking visionary such as Pearson to found the principles on which Kirstenbosch should be established, and in fact mobilizing the good people of Cape Town and the government, from the Lord Chief Justice as chairman of the Board of Trustees in 1913 to some of the most eminent and influential people of the Cape and of South Africa, to Louis Botha, to Jan Smuts, to get them behind the concept of a national botanic garden. He also, Pearson, had the good fortune to recruit a Kew horticulturist, a Kew gardener, in Joseph William Matthews. Jimmy Matthews, who had been in the Cape for a few years as horticulturist in the Cape, the old company garden. Jimmy Matthews is the man that shaped Kirstenbosch and experimented with all the new plants coming into horticulture from the Cape, Kew trained, and he was followed through the first 80 years, well, the first century, sorry, of Kirstenbosch. Kew trained horticulturists were curators. 80 years out of the century, Kew trained horticulturists led the garden's development. So that just emphasizes the link that we have had with Kew in terms of science and horticulture. Pearson sadly died at a young age. He was just in his early 40s. He died in 1916 during the Great War. It took some years to find a replacement, who was Harold Compton, here on the left, with King George, and who we affectionately knew as Jannie Smuts and the Queen Mother, on the top of MacLear's Beacon on their visit to 1947. Compton was a very quiet, focused, serious scientist. He wasn't the sort of visionary, perhaps, that Pearson had been, but he stabilized the work in Kirstenbosch over the many years during which time he was director. Interestingly, the Queen Mother, or Queen Elizabeth, when at Chelsea a few years ago, in her 100th year, happened to stop at this Kirstenbosch stand, Chelsea, and I was there, and I got to having a nice chat with her. And she remarked on her visit in 1947, and indicated, she said she remembered planting a tree at Kirstenbosch. Now, there's no record of this, but I doubt that she would have been mistaken, you know, that she had been to Kirstenbosch, she enjoyed the proteas, she enjoyed the ericas, and she said she enjoyed that they planted a tree at Kirstenbosch. And this remains a mystery, because their visit was not an official visit. It was just an unplanned visit. Jan Smuts swept them into Kirstenbosch. I guess they planted a tree, but I haven't been able to find it. So there's a sort of a mystery for you to help resolve. Here we must bring in the other side of the coin in South African botany in the early 20th century. In Cape Town, we had Pearson and then Compton. Up in Pretoria, we had a feisty, red-haired Welshman in Paul Evans. And Paul Evans had wanted to establish and had established the Botanical Survey of South Africa. He established the publication of Bothalia, of Flowering Plants of Africa. He was an incredibly dynamic man. But there was this polarization, north and south, that lasted for 80 years from the time he came to South Africa in 1905 and established what became the Botanical Research Institute in Pretoria, which was in competition with Compton's National Botanic Gardens in Cape Town. That's a long story of tensions north and south. One of the important things that Paul Evans did, other than establishing these many journals and survey work, research centers around the country, the National Herbarium, he also established South African Botanical Liaison Offices at Kew from 1919. For nearly 70 years, they were young South Africans, went to Kew, mostly taxonomists, and many of these people became important players out of their experience and exposure to the professionalism at Kew, with Ines Verdorn, C.A. Smith, Alan Dyer, who became director, Bernard de Winter, who was director in Pretoria, Ted Oliver down in the Cape here, Charlie Sturton became deputy director at Kew for a period, Peter Linde, who's a famous, made himself one of the key players in the South African Orchidaceae, and Brian Shiro, who's still at Kew. So there's been a sort of continuous linkage between the two, the North and South. But things came to a head in 1923. These tensions had been developing. And Jan Smuts, Paul Evans got Jan Smuts to open the new National Herbarium in 1923. And Jan Smuts said, "You want a Kew? What Kew is to England and the British Empire, this National Herbarium must be to South Africa." Now, this was in Pretoria. Poor Compton was aghast. Now, what's going on here? Here we've got Kirstenbosch, and Paul Evans and Jan Smuts are setting up this place up in the north. And the normally dispassionate scientist, Compton, really got angered. He wrote to the Cape Times and to Nature, the journal in the UK, said, "The government withholds the most urgently necessary grants from Kirstenbosch, South Africa's natural queue, while spending lavishly on the pseudo queue of Pretoria. It is notorious that Kirstenbosch has been and is being starved." So this is bubbling up the tension between North and South around Kew. This must have placed the Kew directors in a bit of a predicament, because they had friends in both Pretoria and Cape Town. And in fact, it was John Hutchinson that came out to South Africa and spent many years here, mostly as the guest of Jan Smuts. He worked with all the leaders in botany in South Africa. And I think he helped bridge this rift between North and South. Interestingly, Jan Smuts was a great patron of botany. He supported and, in fact, took Hutchinson on travels all the way up to Tanganyika, through to Uganda, down through what is today Zambia, Katanga. And in his foreword to John Hutchinson's book, because John Hutchinson became the keeper of the herbarium in Kew, Smuts had a good feel for what botany needed, and I suspect he was not entirely convinced that Kew knew what it should embrace. So he said that Hutchinson had still to complete his studies and to graduate in the great university of travel. He had studied Africa dead in the herbarium. He had still to see it living in the sun, on the mountains and plains, in the heat and drought, in rain and swamp, in the shadows and the insulation of the so-called dark continent. He had to see it to believe. So he took Hutchinson, this great Kew botanist, and traveled through Africa. Smuts mended the relationship, the strained relationship between North and South, when he came to the Silver Jubilee Festival in Kirstenbosch in 1938, and his comment was, "For 25 years, this garden has been in existence, and it has more than justified its existence." And, you know, you say, well, Kirstenbosch, good, it's okay. Now, let's go to the last episode. Sorry. Things sort of moved along after the 30s. They moved along fairly slowly between the linkages between Cuba and South Africa. But they started to get a new energy in 1990. It all, of course, started with the release of Nelson Mandela. The same year, the National Botanical Institute was established. A few years later, after the inauguration of Mandela, a law reform process and a whole suite of new laws enabling the establishment of many new institutions, including the South African National Biodiversity Institute, which is the umbrella institute under which Kirstenbosch falls. On the very special day, 11th February 1990, the day in which Mandela was released from prison, a group of young botanists met in Maputo, Mozambique, to discuss the future of botany in the new South Africa. And this group got together and decided to form what became known as SABANET, the Southern African Botanical Diversity Network. And this provided the basis for a continuing series of expeditions and collaborations all around Southern Africa, including this. You can see the plant pressures bulging. This is up on the Nyika Plateau in Malawi. And a series of expeditions in Angola, Botswana, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Zambia, brought together botanists who had been separated for so many years until the 1990s, and established a new era for botany in the region, including the preparation of authoritative checklists of the flora of South African plants, the plants of Southern Africa, and ultimately the whole of Sub-Saharan Africa. So the inventorization and characterization of the flora of Africa received a huge impulse through this linkage between South Africa, Kew, and 60 or 70 other institutions around the world. One of the big projects at Kew in the last 10 years has been the Millennium Seed Bank project, which is housed at Wakehurst Place in England. And one of the targets was to collect seeds of 10% of the flora of all the different countries around the world by 2010. And this, in fact, South Africa and the South African team was the first to complete that. Also, the inventorization of threatened plants has been a program which Gren Lucas, when he was keeper at the Herbarium in Kew, he invited me in 1979 to join with him in Sir Peter Scott's what was called the Species Survival Commission, which set about preparing red data books for birds, mammals, fishes, plants. And South Africa is now the leading country in terms of documentation of the threatened species and role and ways in which to protect those threatened species of South Africa's 20,000 plus indigenous plants. Now, Pearson, again, we could have a whole day on Pearson. One of Pearson's observations, irritations, should we say, was that he says, the inheritors of one of the most remarkable and most beautiful of existing floras take so little interest in it that we have not yet been at the trouble to bring its treasures into cultivation. He looked at South African gardens. South African plants were absent in South African gardens at the turn of the century. And he regarded this as a disgrace. He could find more South African plants in the gardens of Berlin, of London, of Paris than he could here. Well, things changed, obviously. One of the great contributions of Kirstenbosch has been through those wonderful plantsmen that came and joined us from Kew, the production of what we know in Kirstenbosch today. Research was another of Pearson's passions, as it was of Compton's and Eloff's in succession. And we established, as I've mentioned, the Sabinet project, taking young groups of young students around Africa on expeditions, such as this one up in the mountains of Angola, where Pearson had passed by a century before. Here we've got young botanists from Kew and elsewhere in Africa, Zimbabwe, Malawi, in the mountains and down in the Congo Basin, collecting expeditions with our colleagues at Kew. So in terms of survey of the flora of southern Africa, there's been remarkable collaboration. Pearson wanted to have a research facility at Kirstenbosch. In fact, he saw that as the fundamental criterion of a proper botanic garden was a research center. And it took 80 years before Kirstenbosch got a research center, which we now have, and is a wonderful facility used by colleagues around the world. And the final point that Pearson raised was that we needed a network of gardens. Therefore, quite apart from mere geographical considerations, it is obvious that a single garden, however large and well equipped, will not serve the whole of South Africa. That was his view in 1910, soon after, and particularly during the time of Brian Rycroft, the network of gardens was established, and the most recent, of course, up at Huntum, at Nieuwoudtville, where the treasures of geophytes are in abundance. That was our ninth garden. There is a tenth garden being planned right now, just near East London on the coast. Now, as we all know, gardens around the world have suffered financial woes. In fact, it's the last comment here, that, 1881, Peter McCowan said, South African botany has to carry on a perpetual fight against insolvency. Well, I don't believe that that is necessarily the case. At Kirstenbosch, in the last two decades, we've been able to convert it from a garden dependent on government handouts to a cash cow for the Institute as a whole, built on happy visitors spending money freely. Visitors are what one needs, young and old, smelling the flowers or listening to music or looking at sculpture or eating in a restaurant. That's collectively provides the funding necessary to run a botanical institute. Now, I'll just end this talk on the Kew connection with a happy note that when Kew celebrated, the Royal Botanic Garden celebrated its 250th anniversary a couple of years ago, they established the Kew International Medal. And they had the graciousness to see fit to award this to me 2 years ago. So the Kew connection between Kirstenbosch and the Kew Gardens has been sort of, at least for me, personalized with that. I end just with one of many pictures of that most beautiful garden in Africa. I'm sure you all know it well. I would hope that you visit it regularly and that you spend freely on your visits. Thank you.